This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 29th of August 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Robert Bounds, coming up in the next 60 minutes. Aerotropolis projects. Zurich Airport is getting prepared for a massive construction project to create a city around it. At the same time, UK airport discussion is stuck with a debate on what to do with Heathrow. We'll ask if airports are a benchmark of competitiveness. We'll also speak to our technology correspondent about the biggest announcement heard today at the Berlin IFA. That's the largest consumer electronics show in the world. And after Stockholm Fashion Week, where is Sweden fashion headed? We speak to Swedish pop star Emilia Deparé, who has been all the buzz in Stockholm during the last week.
I think the Swedes are quite proud of their style and look, and we, I think we want to be ambassadors when we travel. We want to wear Acne or Y-Red or Filippa K. It's like part of our costumes. I definitely think that we want to show what we have here.
All that, plus we play some great music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's get the news headlines with Roger Crisp.
Monocle 24 News. Feuding South African unions, platinum producer Lonmin and government officials tried today to broker a peace accord at a mine where 44 people were killed in the worst such violence since the end of apartheid. They also want to use the meeting to start pay talks over the dispute that has paralysed production at Lonmin's Marikana mine and raised worries of unrest spreading through the country's platinum sector, further shaking the economy. Labour market analyst Richard Pike says the meeting process has inbuilt flaws.
But I think one of the problems that we do have is we have this alliance between government and the trade union movement, COSATU. So government almost can't play honest broker because it's in an alliance with one of the parties. And I think that's one of the things that I'm quite concerned about and that has actually precipitated the rocky road that we see in labour relations at the moment.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu has withdrawn as a speaker at a one-day leadership summit in Johannesburg in protest at sharing a stage with Tony Blair, calling the former British Prime Minister's support of the US-led Iraq invasion morally indefensible. Mr. Tutu's office wrote to the organisers that the Nobel Peace Prize laureate's decision was as a result of Mr. Blair's action to support the United States on the basis of unproven allegations of the existence in Iraq of weapons of mass destruction. President Bashar al-Assad has dismissed talk of a Western-imposed buffer zone on Syrian territory as unrealistic. In an interview on Syrian TV, he said that the situation in his country is better, but that more time is needed to win the conflict against rebels trying to overthrow him. And meanwhile, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has said today that the Syrian opposition needs to be unified as preparation to take on the responsibility of running the country. Hurricane Isaac has reached land in southeastern Louisiana with winds of 80 miles an hour and is now heading for New Orleans exactly 7 years after Hurricane Katrina hit the city. There are reports that water has already flowed over the top of a levee to the southeast of New Orleans, threatening severe flooding. Oil and gas platforms in the Gulf of Mexico have been shut down, and New Orleans residents are taking no chances either.
Just taking no chances. And as you can see, we pack like it's Katrina again, because last time we lost everything, and we're not taking any chance.
We normally evacuate to the French Quarter for storms. It's the highest part of the city, and we feel real comfortable down here.
The Supreme Court in India has upheld the death penalty passed on Muhammad Ajmal Amir Khazab, the sole survivor from the terrorist gang which carried out the attacks in Mumbai in 2008 when 165 people were killed. Digvijay Singh, leader of India's ruling Congress party, has welcomed today's ruling.
I would like to congratulate Honorable Supreme Court for upholding the death sentence of Mr. Khazab. I think the justice should be delivered as soon as possible, and there should not be any delay in it.
The European Commission says it will be investigating Ryanair's latest attempt to take over Aer Lingus. The Commission, concerned about competition issues, already blocked a previous takeover bid by Ryanair in 2006. And the 69th Venice Film Festival opens today with half the number of films as previous years, reflecting the global economic situation. The opening film is The Reluctant Fundamentalist, based on a novel of the same name, which traces a young Pakistani's journey from being a Wall Street high flyer to suspected Islamist radical targeted by American intelligence. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Roger. It's 5 minutes past 6 p.m. here in London, and you're tuned in to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobropa Jalavert, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're back. It's Midori House with me, Robert Bound, live from Studio One in London. Zurich Airport is getting ready for a massive construction project. The Circle at Zurich Airport will see a 200,000 square metre building development for innovation services and businesses. While in the UK, the discussion is stuck around the topic of what to do with Heathrow. Should it be enlarged, or should London get a new airport somewhere else, or neither? To shed a little light on these aerospace and infrastructure issues, I'm joined in the studio now by Christopher Choa, principal with ACOM, the International Land Development and Infrastructure Consultancy. Christopher, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Robert.
I wondered first, I think we addressed it in our introduction a while back, if airports are sort of regarded internationally as a benchmark of competitiveness, of go-gettingness, of kind of looking to the future?
Well, I think it's not just the airport. It's a combination of the airport and the city. I think in this century that we're living in, we're starting to see something very interesting happening, and that is a diminishment in the power of the nation and the role of the nation, and the increase in the role of the city. And cities are having more in common with each other thousands of miles away than they do with their own hinterland. So what actually binds the cities together are the airports. The airports are the gateway for that kind of communication. So that's, I think, one of the things we're seeing right now.
I mean, it's a funny thing, we talk about the sort of cities want to be closer together. Zurich's quite a nice city. It just won our sort of best place to live, our most livable city in our summer issue. Is Zurich Airport so far away from Zurich, the city? It's not a very big country that we need an aerotropolis to sit alongside the airport and the city.
Well, this is the fascinating thing. If you think about how cities developed over centuries, in the age of donkeys and shoe leather, you had places like Jerusalem, and the marketplaces were well connected to the gates of the city. In the age of sail, you had great ports with all the economy very, very closely associated to the gateway of the coastline. You can think of great cities along rivers, great cities built around railroad stations. Every city is determined by the form of transportation that serves it. And in the age of global cities, of international cities, of global supply chain, you're going to find more and more industries and services that for one reason or another need to have a very close relationship to the airport. And this is measured not just in terms of distance, but also time.
It was a fascinating idea, like taking a sort of historical or historiographical view of this kind of thing. I mean, the London mayor, Boris Johnson, has been sort of waving a fairly big flag for a new runway down in the Thames estuary. I don't know whether he's used this argument, actually, that you know, which is something as a classicist I think he could possibly do fairly well, that if you look back in time, things to be near where they are. Is this completely discounting the fact that communications can be done via Skype, via telephone lines, even to be old-fashioned? Is this all about reinventing face-to-face communication?
Well, this is also an interesting paradox, really, if you think about it. Every technological innovation that was designed to overcome distance ultimately brings people closer together. So in the age of sail, you had parchments going across on sailing ships, creating affinities, and eventually people travel. You have the telegraph, the telephone, the fax machine, the internet. You have social media. These would argue for disaggregating populations, but actually it brings them closer together. One of the things that airlines like doing, for example, is they monitor internet trunk traffic. If they see an increase in traffic between, say, Frankfurt and Yerevan, Lufthansa will lay on the flights.
Because that's an interesting thing. The idea that if you there's not an if you build it they will come. It's the opposite way around with airlines for freight or for passengers, presumably.
Right. If they communicate, they will go. That's really, I think that's the new adage.
And what happens to cities? I can ask you this as Principal ACOM as well, because it's not just about the airports and the infrastructure. Mm. What happens to cities when, I mean, will we have a sort of out-of-town shopping mall mentality? We hear what this did to Walmart in the US. In the UK, people are familiar with sort of what out-of-town Tesco's and large superstores do to smaller towns. Mm. Is Zurich going to fall by the wayside because of the circle?
Well, I think actually Zurich could be a very good model for London in many ways. It's a much smaller airport. It's a much smaller city. I would argue that London is truly a global city. Zurich is not really that. London currently is a global air hub. Zurich is not that. But what we're really seeing now is the very beginning of something, which is no longer to have a city airport on the periphery of the city, but an airport city, which is effectively a business district, a central business district that connects the airport very closely with the city. Zurich Airport's only about 8 miles from Zurich, but it's incredibly well served by trains, by trams, by buses. So like in parts of London now, you can get to and from the airport and the hinterland city very, very easily. It's effectively one thing. It's not two different things.
I've just come back from Brazil. I was in São Paulo and in Rio. And both the airports seem to be ridiculously far away from the cities. Mm. And in fact, the new sort of, it's called Brooklyn, which is the sort of new development in São Paulo, which is the sort of enclosure for these kind of butchy glitz skyscrapers, is completely the other end from the airport. I mean, is there an opportunity? I mean, both those cities obviously have local regional airports as well. But is there a case to be made for smaller airports popping up inside the ring of the city, inside the green belt of the city almost?
Well, I think what you saw in Sao Paulo is maybe sort of the after...
Which I don't know whether that has a green belt.
Yeah. It's also an after echo of an older idea. Uh-huh. I think the issue of making place is still very important. And I think that's going to be the challenge for a lot of these places. It's no longer just can you bang on a high-speed rail connection to the city. Can you make it so integrated that there really is very little difference temporally between the city and the airport? And in some cases, can you specialize? Maybe not everybody, but are there some businesses that really need the access to the airport very strongly? And can you make an urban place, an attractive civic place, in the same way that we now know how to make attractive cities?
And this is and presumably this is very much for the business traveler, and also for the kind of people that are doing business with the kind of tech startups. I mean, what sort of businesses attach themselves or will attach themselves to Circle? I know there's going to be a Hyatt hotel or two as part of this development, but what sort of businesses crowd around these sort of new localized airports?
Well, I would say in general, any business that in one way or another needs connection with other cities. And what business doesn't? It's not just cargo and logistics. It's also professional services. I live in London. I love living in London. It's a great place. We have a very busy office here. I have almost 80% of my work internationally. So London to me is a hub, not just for travel, but as a place to live because I can get to other places very well. And I choose to live here and my company chooses to work here because of that. If London wasn't well connected, I could easily move to Amsterdam and do exactly what I'm doing right now, and that would be a lovely place for me to live.
Yeah.
And that's the argument. The interesting economic argument is compelling, too, because for a major, well-connected hub airport, every regularly scheduled long-haul flight supports between 2,000 and 3,000 direct and indirect jobs. That's a huge number. That's just not the people who are working on the airlines or in the hotels. It's the whole urban hinterland that's enabled by that.
And we don't want to, and that's obviously a strong argument for the sort of pro-third runway group that are circling around Heathrow. But as someone that lives in London, works in London, we have to ask you possibly to end, is London a well-connected city? Does it need this third runway?
Well, London is a global hub. It has been a hub for centuries. It has all the specialization and competitive advantage that make it a great place to work and live. But it is a constrained air hub. it is actually in dire straits, and that many people don't realize it until they actually look at the numbers or they actually think about how long these have to circle before they land. You lose a connectivity, then you lose the economic
And this vitality. Is missing a flight by your flight landing late.
Well, if you can't connect to the emerging world, how do you grow?
Okay, because it sounds like a sort of conversation we could have been having in sort of the 1930s, and I suppose this is an idea that airports have to reinvent themselves, or certainly the places around them have to. Mm. Well, for the time being, Charles Schoer, principal with ACOM, thanks very much for joining us on Midori House. Yep. Charles from the International Land Development and Infrastructure Consultancy. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back with a revelation that has angered many Germans, that the country has been supporting police forces in Belarus, otherwise known as the last dictatorship in Europe. It's a case of stay tuned.
Marseille, renowned for its multicultural makeup and hard edges, is a city being reshaped. To discover the beating heart of Marseille, Monocle Films visits three hoteliers who reflect the evolution of this heady Mediterranean city: Au Vieux Panier, Le Petit Nice, and Hotel Le Corbusier.
I always used to say that we are here to share our passion. Here we are so proud of the building, so emotionally attached to the work of Le Corbusier that we are proud of it and we want to share it.
Marseille in Motion. Monocle Films on monocle.com.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in. From Barenna jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
And it's just coming up to 17 minutes past 6 p.m. here in London, which means you're tuned in to Midori House. Now, many Germans have been upset by the revelation that Germany have been training and equipping the Belarusian police force for over 2 years. The German public is questioning why German money and knowledge has been used to support the forces of a country otherwise known as the last dictatorship in Europe. We're joined on the line now by Jörg Thorbrig, Senior Programme Officer and Director of Funds for Belarus Democracy in Berlin. Jörg, thanks for joining us on Midori House.
Good to be online with you. Thank you. Now,
this is an interesting story. Maybe we should give our listeners a sort of overview of exactly what's been going on. First of all, how was this story broken in the German media?
This only emerged a few days ago, basically. We do know that there have been inquiries by parliamentarians already last year, but this is story that only was confirmed a couple of days ago. Basically, about a week ago, a first German newspaper here in Berlin reported on this story, and then very quickly, Germany's largest tabloid, Bild, brought this story out into the open fully. Then there have been a number of reactions, especially by Germany's interior minister, but I expect that there will be a more fuller inquiry and investigation of this issue in the weeks to come.
Now, I guess some resources are shared in the European Union, and this is sort of one of those things. But I think Berlin's involvement in Belarus was due to their sort of promising that they were going to become more democratic. Is this right?
Yeah, this is right. Basically, this cooperation that was now uncovered on a police level between Germany and Belarus was part of a broader process of building closer relationships with Belarus that started in about 2008. Back then, there were indications from the Belarusian side that they were willing to cooperate more closely with Europe, that they were even willing to undertake some steps of liberalization, of loosening the dictatorship that otherwise reigns in that country for the last 18 years. And Western and German hopes were that through closer cooperation with the country, one could gently nudge the regime in Minsk in the direction of an opening of political reforms eventually. Now, this process, this warming of relationships, came to an end in 2010 when there were presidential elections in December 2010. And despite all the promises from the Belarusian side, these elections were neither free nor fair. And on the contrary, when thousands of people came out in protest after the elections, they were brutally put down by a police force, and to this very day there are prisoners behind bars going back to that evening.
Okay, Jörg, and you mentioned there that these protests were put down by police forces. Is there any evidence that these could have been the German police forces helping out with this operation? I mean, is that the accusation, or is it simply that they have been involved with Belarus?
Well, this would be very far-fetched. What we know at this stage is that there were a whole number of trainings, of exchanges, of study visits on a number of issues. There were reports in the German press that a number of Belarusian police officials were witness to a large protest in Germany, which was controlled by police. That was an anti-nuclear protest back then. But it would be very far-fetched to draw a direct line between the training and transfer of knowledge and experiences from Germany to Belarus on the police level to the events of December 2010 and the post-election crackdown on civil society.
And just to give the German police possibly a sort of moral clean bill of health or not, was this something that the German police had already pulled out of, or have they pulled out of Belarus because of this uncovering and this splash by Bild?
Well, the official line at the moment, the official statement from the Federal Minister of the Interior is that this cooperation was ended last year, which means well after the presidential elections and the crackdown afterwards. There is a statement by the Belarusian Interior Ministry today that this cooperation ended well before the presidential elections in 2010. So again, these are all points that we will need to have clarified in the weeks to come, and I believe there will be inquiries, especially on part of German members of parliament, that will be lodged with the relevant authorities here in Germany.
And Belarus, it seems like sort of the German police have been sort of sold up the river slightly. It seems Belarus have been sort of intelligent and nimble in their ability to be sort of part of Interpol, for example, but sort of not play by a lot of the other rules that govern international politics, or certainly European politics. Is this the case? I mean, have they been sort of quite clever to accept German help and get away with it for so long in a way?
Well, yes, I think this is the main point that we should take away from this incident. There are naturally forms of cooperation between our countries and Belarus. If you only take the issue of organized crime, of cross-border, even terrorist networks, then obviously there needs to be a basic level of cooperation, even with a country like Belarus that politically is oriented in a completely different direction than we in our European and democratic countries. So some degree of cooperation there needs to be. But obviously, the Belarusian government has become very smart in exploiting these international accords and forms of cooperation for its own and very often domestic and political purposes. So if you mention Interpol, for instance, Belarus is part of that. Primarily, it is part of that with the intention of working on issues like organized crime. But then what Belarus does is that it puts political opponents on international search warrants in order to reach them, even if they have emigrated and live in exile in Europe now. Another example that emerged last year, a similar incident, was that the Belarusian authorities asked Polish and Lithuanian authorities to provide private banking information on accounts held by Belarusian dissidents in Poland and Lithuania. Both countries obliged, with the result that one of the key human rights activists in Belarus today is in prison now for 4.5 years on the basis of charges of tax evasion that were brought to him on the basis of this data. So in that sense, the case that broke now about police cooperation between Germany and Belarus fits that broader picture, in my opinion. And it goes to show that very clearly we have not adjusted our own mechanisms, our own institutional approaches to Belarus, to the fact that there is a miserable human rights situation and a very, very non-democratic political situation in that country today.
And lastly on that, Jörg, and finally, do you think that this might do some good then? The fact that the Belarusian regime is in the headlines for the right or wrong reasons, nonetheless, we're talking about it today.
Well, I would hope that this is a wake-up call for us. I would hope that this incident serves as a reminder that we on our side need to adjust in our approaches in order to live up to the promises that we do on a political level. On a political level, our countries, and Germany especially, has become very critical of the regime in Belarus. It pledges support to the democratic movement, to civil society, to independent media in Belarus. But obviously, we need to avoid that we play into the wrong hands by maintaining the forms of cooperation with the Belarusian regime that we developed for completely different intentions than they exploit them for now. So in that sense, I would hope that this is a wake-up call that helps us also to rethink our approaches to a country like Belarus, because we shouldn't forget that Belarus is not the only dictatorship in the world. There are other countries, especially in the former Soviet Union, that are moving in a very similar direction, be it Russia, be it the Republic of Central Asia, be it Azerbaijan. So we would be well advised to take the example of Belarus as a context that we will be dealing with more and more in the years to come, and that we need to adjust our policies, our institutional arrangements, our forms of cooperation with those countries.
Okay, well, Jörg, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. That was Jörg Forbrig, Senior Programme Officer and Director of Funds for Belarus Democracy. And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And before the news headlines at the bottom of the hour, we're going to have some music from Paris. This is Phoenix, If I Ever Feel Better.
They say an end can be a start. Feels like a barbarian still alive. It's like a bad day that never ends. I feel the chaos around me, a thing I don't try to deny. I better learn to accept that there are things in my life I can't control. They say love is nothing but a sore. I don't even know what love is. Too many tears I've had to fall. Don't you know I'm so tired of it all?
We took a trip down to Versailles to hear Phoenix and If I Ever Feel Better. In the next half hour of the show, we'll be finding out what about the big announcements are at the world's biggest consumer electronics show, the IFA in Berlin. And we'll also get the latest from the Venice Biennale of Architecture and Stockholm Fashion Week. But first, at the bottom of the hour, here's Roger Crisp with the news headlines.
Thanks, Rob. Feuding South African unions, platinum producer Lonmin and government officials tried today to broker a peace accord at a mine where 44 people were killed in the worst such violence since the end of apartheid in South Africa. Archbishop Desmond Tutu has withdrawn as a speaker at a one-day leadership summit in Johannesburg in protest at sharing a stage with Tony Blair, calling the former British Prime Minister's support of the US-led Iraq invasion morally indefensible. President Bashar al-Assad has dismissed talk of a Western-imposed buffer zone on Syrian territory as unrealistic. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has said today that the Syrian opposition needs to be unified as preparation to take on the responsibility of running the country. Hurricane Isaac has reached land in southeastern Louisiana with winds of 80 miles an hour and is now heading for New Orleans, and oil and gas platforms in the Gulf of Mexico have been shut down. The Supreme Court in India has upheld the death penalty passed on Muhammad Ajmal Amir Kassab, the sole survivor from the terrorist gang which carried out the attacks in Mumbai in 2008 when 165 people were killed. And the European Commission says it will be investigating Ryanair's latest attempt to take over Aer Lingus. The Commission, concerned about competition issues, had already blocked a previous takeover bid by Ryanair in 2006. And those are the headlines here on Monocle 24.
And you have been safely returned back to Midori House on Local 24, where we're going to come to you live now from London. Except we're going to go off to Berlin, I think, next. That's right, because we've got our technology correspondent, David Phelan, who's headed to the German capital for the world's largest consumer electronics show, the IFA, the Internationale Funkausstellung. David, can you correct my German pronunciation?
I'd rather not. That's why everyone calls it IFA, because no one can quite say what it means. They always have a catchy tagline attached to it as well, but it never quite translates. It's something like the lust for the new or something like that. It changes every year. It never translates properly.
It doesn't sound that sexy, does it? So you haven't been wearing your free T-shirt about the place then?
No, that's right.
So first of all, we should kind of sort the men from the boys. At the Venice Biennale, which is one of my sort of trade fairs, they always do these amazing tote bags. Then I went to the Geneva Car Show, where they do just a plethora of memory sticks. What's the thing that you've been given too many of so far at IFA?
Nothing. It's quite demure like that. Tomorrow there will be, or Friday actually, when the show gets really going for the public, there'll be a lot of scantily clad women handing out exactly those kind of USB sticks and other things you really will never use again or even look at. But that's the thing they go big on.
And we should talk about the big announcements. I hear that TVs are sort of getting bigger, and this is the big splash so far.
Yes. I mean, it's only just getting going. The big announcements so far have been Sony, Panasonic and Samsung. Sony announced a stunning-looking 84-inch TV, but that's big. But the remarkable thing about it is the resolution. Full HD, as you know, Rob, means you've got 1920 pixels along the long end and just over 1,000 in the short end. This has double that in both directions, so it's four times the resolution of full HD. You thought there couldn't be anything fuller than full HD. This is four times as full.
How full is full? Is this kind of like a glass a glass brimming over with resolution?
Exactly. I think they should call it overflowing HD. And that's a massive and beautiful screen that will go on sale later this year for €25,000. A snip at the price. Mm-hmm. But not to be outdone, Panasonic has announced a 143-inch screen with double that resolution. So it's 8,000 pixels along the long end instead of 4,000. And it defies all belief. The problem with it is that it looks astonishingly realistic. Sony showed a beautiful video of Simon Rattle conducting the Berliner Philharmonic, but you can't get the content. Movies like Spider-Man are shot in 4K, so that will work perfectly, but there's no domestic way to get at that except through Blu-ray and DVD, which are much lower resolution, mm-hmm. So that will have to follow. But when we get it, it will look amazing.
I was going to ask you about, I mean, this is called, we preface this as the Consumer Electronics Show, and it seems like these are the kind of things that you'd really kind of, they're probably great for seeing the Rolling Stones playing live in the next county, but maybe not in your living room.
Yes, and I think Panasonic is saying that their TV is mostly going to be for public use, for commercial use rather than home use. But the 84-inch TV, that could definitely, if you've got a big enough living room, I guess the screen is no bigger than many people have projection TVs and can deliver much bigger images than that if they've got a big enough wall.
And I wondered about sort of whether when Sony and Panasonic and LG put out these products at IFA, and this is obviously the grand sort of unveiling of these things, does this sort of affect their kind of stock? I mean, I know that Sony Television were sort of in trouble in terms of their manufacturing, and they'd sort of been sort of superseded. Is this a sort of big kind of a sort of statement of their robustness, their commercial robustness, as much as anything else?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is a big year for Sony. They've had a lot of troubles in the last year, not least their boss, Howard Stringer, has now been replaced by Katsuo Hirai, and this was his first big event. And I must say he handled it very well. He was very bullish and confident. He was Japanese, which will please the Sony locals in Japan, and he spoke fluent fast English, which will please everyone else. So he did a great job, and you felt there was a kind of a fight back going on, and certainly they had more products than you would have imagined from Sony. Rather like last year, they slightly stole the show last year as well at IFA.
And it's not just TVs, of course, there's all the other stuff, phones, cameras, all this sort of stuff. Is there anything else that sort of jumped out so far, David?
Yeah, there's a very neat camera which has downloadable apps. So apps won't just be on your phone anymore. And it's not the only camera that you can put apps on, but this one has specific camera apps that you can download to add extra features and special effects. There's a remarkable, I don't know if I can quite describe it, cinematic effect for pictures, so that you take a still shot of, I don't know, a hotel lobby with a fountain in the corner, but you can keep part of the picture animated so that it puts a video file into it as well, so that the hotel lobby is still, but the water is flowing in the fountain as it would do in real life.
I'm trying to guess where you're staying now in Berlin. sounds great. Yeah. And is this the thing? Is there a sense that cameras, traditional cameras that do sort of one job, taking pictures, they're having to catch up with the iPhones and the Samsung Galaxies of this world with having these sort of extra downloadable applications?
Definitely. I think you can't beat, obviously, a real camera for images. Apart from anything else, no smartphone has an optical zoom on it. But it's true that cameras are really running to catch up with the things that a phone is great at, like sharing your photos very easily. So that camera that I just talked about, the Sony NEX 5R, and a couple of others are now having Wi-Fi built in so that you can share your pictures really quickly and easily. And it's absolutely catching up with smartphones.
And there always seems, I guess, to be that thing of having something that looks like a purist instrument, but also is actually very usable in, you know, all the sort of online applications that it would be used for, I guess. And is there a sort of snobbery at these things that sort of someone's got too many features for it to be a proper purist instrument? Or
I think with cameras, especially more expensive cameras, you can't have too many dials. People aren't so bothered about touch screens. Those exactly are rather looked down on as gimmicky and for the mobile phone brigade. But the more dials you have and clever buttons that do very, very specific functions, the better you're going to be.
All right, well, for the time being, David Phelan, thank you very much for joining us on the line from Berlin. We'll let our listeners try to figure out by the power of Google image search where exactly your hotel is by the description of its lobby. For the time being, thank you very much. You're tuned in to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a check-in with Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, who's been at the Venice Biennale of Architecture.
The September issue of Monocle is a global survey of flashpoints and fighting forces. In this inaugural defence-themed issue, our editors put on their flak jackets and pop on their helmets as they investigate everything from how to create a modern fighting force to how to design state-of-the-art camouflage. And we have lots more to offer too.
In the affairs section, we climb on board the USS George Washington to see why aircraft carriers still rule the waves. We head to Norway to visit the world's best officer training school. And I nip over to Brussels to interview Anders Fogh Rasmussen, Secretary General of NATO.
In the business section this month, we go inside the studios of America's leading camouflage designers, we take a look at the big businesses that have surprising defence interests, and we report on the major deals taking place at Farnborough this year. We also have our first entrepreneur's guide, a comprehensive look at how to set up shop. The battle-ready September issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, and also available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Every Saturday at midday in London, join our editors on Monocle 24 for The Review. We take you on a tour of three bookshops in three cities to hear what's flying off the shelves. We listen to some top tracks with a music aficionado from a different region. And we review a stack of our favourite new magazines each week too. That's The Review, the perfect way to start your weekend, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome home to the Midori House, listeners. Now, the Venice Biennale of Architecture is one of the most important events in the international design calendar. It gives some of the world's best-known architects a chance to showcase new projects and share ideas about new innovations in the industry. And our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, has been in Venice all week for the event and is on the phone now to give us his final update, he possibly hopes. Hugo, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Rob.
Now, first of all, I've got to ask you whether you've had mostly a wet bum or very tired feet this week. Has it been a lot of water taxing or a lot of walking?
It's a lot of walking, as I'm sure you know yourself, particularly when you're doing films out here. Everything happens between two locations. That's a good 15-minute walk, and you spend all day running backwards and forwards trying to keep on top of the schedule of interviews that you have booked. So I've got feet covered in blisters at the moment.
Sounds like an edifying image, and it's like it's radio. We'll save those for the film, I guess. But has it felt confident? Have you felt a sort of other than anything briny off the air? Have you felt that people have been kind of that there's enough money maybe to for people to be really creative, or have been people been more kind of practical this year?
Things have been divided in two. At the one end, you have these big architects who just don't seem to go away, putting on enormous showcases that seem a little bit unnecessary and slightly at odds with financial climate that everybody's more than aware of. At the other end, just the more impressive, interesting problem-solving shows that have actually been the ones that have done very well in the Golden Lions, that are the awards that are announced on the last day of the press week. And the winner of the Best Pavilion was the Japanese, who showcased a project called Home for All. And perhaps unsurprisingly, it was all focused on a new typology of emergency disaster housing for the region that was hit by the earthquake and tsunami last year. So what the Biennale really should be about is addressing some urgent problems that need architects to think of a new way of building and a new sort of typology. It shouldn't really be about Zaha Hadid having a massive sculpture in the middle of the El Finale.
Yeah, no, you're right. And it's particularly interesting that these topics come up in Venice. You know, as you mentioned, I've been there for the Art Biennale a couple of times. And it's that same thing of being in a bit, you know, decay and ruin is sort of such an artistic kind of idea. And also the idea of conservation is very much one of the sort of key design ideas, I guess, or having to come to terms with something that's sort of falling to bits and make it sort of better. Does it feel like Venice is still very well placed to be the place to have this sort of big architecture biennale rather than maybe some new town in the middle of a desert or New York City or London or somewhere like that?
Well, it was interesting at the awards ceremony, Paolo Baratta, the director, started by saying that if architecture is the mother of the arts, then Italy is the mother of architecture. And he highlighted how difficult it is to be an architect in Italy today, and said many people, exactly as you've just said, might think that Venice is a little bit old-fashioned and perhaps there should be an sort of update or a new location to host the biggest gathering of architects in the world. But he said that at the same time, Italy still has an extraordinary sensibility. And the very fragility of Venice, again, as you mentioned, puts it in the perfect sort of position or platform in which to discuss all of these ideas of change and decay and preservation and conservation and problem solving, really, which is sort of at the heart of what architecture is all about.
And I guess it's not everything is just as perfect as one of those Venetian bridges or a water taxi. When you're in a place like Venice, you have to think of kind of ways to get of getting from one place to another as quickly as you can. And it's it often is on foot, Hugo, right?
Well, indeed it is. Had blisters, Rob.
And I wanted to ask you about this about the protest outside the Russian Pavilion during the was this during the Golden Lion Awards?
It was during the Golden Lion announcement, which happened in the middle of the Giardini, where all the national pavilions are, and it's a very very polite, mannered event. Lots of people in suits, and the Minister of Culture, the Minister of Affairs, the Minister of the Interior were there, as well as the Mayor of Venice. And Russia was given a special mention when it came to delivering the awards. And no sooner had the mention been given than suddenly, about 50 metres behind us, there was a terrific outburst of chanting just outside the Russian pavilion of Free, Free, Pussy Riot. And suddenly all the police that had been monitoring the event just sort of leapt over the barriers. And suddenly it turned into a full-scale sort of riot with a march and banners and whistles and klaxons and police with riot gear emerged from nowhere and sort of tried to shut them as quickly and as quietly as possible out of the way so that proceedings could go on. But it was a very unlikely event to take place in an otherwise very sort of polite occasion.
It sounds like the sort of thing that should sort of probably happen at the Venice Biennale, at the Art Biennale. It's probably going to be the next Russian pavilion, Hugo.
I know exactly. And also it's slightly ironic because the Russian Pavilion took its whole theme of these towns in the 1950s during the Cold War that were spied on by the Russians, and nobody knew that these towns existed, and it was all about surveillance and monitoring and shutting down any freedom of speech. Slightly carelessly chosen topic, I think, in light of recent events.
Yeah, it sounds like accidentally poignant, doesn't it? It sounds
very, very much so.
Yeah. Well, Hugo, thank you so much for joining us on Midori House. We'll let you kind of stay update free for a couple of days, and we'll welcome you back to the office in a couple of days too.
Thank you. See you tomorrow.
Thanks a lot. And that was Hugo McDonald, our design editor, who was in Venice. Next up, we'll be speaking to Amelia Depere.
This is Monocle 24.
This is indeed Monocle 24, and you're listening to Midori House with me, Robert Bound. In Stockholm, fashionistas have been getting together for Stockholm Fashion Week, which is now nearing an end. Singer, writer, and Monocle regular Amelia Depere has been seeing all the Fashion Week buzz, and she spoke to Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards, earlier.
The day started really early with a breakfast show in the kind of artsy neighborhood of Stockholm called SoFo. And it was an opening of a store for a brand called Hope and also a fashion show. And the models were integrated with the audience. And it was really cool. Very nice. A very good start of the day.
Now, you mentioned that brand there. There's so many others. We've got, you know, Acne, Philippa K, Tiger of Sweden. What is it that makes Sweden so good at these fashion businesses? I mean, is it about marketing, how they sell them to the world? Is it about branding? Why are they so good at this?
I think they're very good with concepts. So they're very good creating something that they keep a concept in everything they do, the clothes, the marketing, the way they brand the labels. And I think it's just they're very talented in that sense. And fashion itself is really wearable. And I met with a street style photographer just now, and he said that he would label the Swedish look casual chic. And I think that's really what it is. It's like clothes for everyone, for every occasion, and it's really easy and wearable.
Now, it's interesting that you mentioned a photographer there, because I know that there is this real sort of popular street style in Stockholm that a lot of fashion photographers and people who are trying to monitor trends are really interested in. Are there any sort of particular fashion style tips that you would sort of pass on as being the things to watch?
No, I mean, the thing is, again, like, people are quite casual here, but they still do it in a really chic and cool way. You don't see that many heels like you see in Paris. You don't see that many expensive designers and stuff like that. People rather wear like something from Acne mixed with something vintage, like throw on a pair of Converse. But there's always something that stands out, if that is a cool oversized coat or some funky shoes. But it's not like a whole full look. It's not like over the top or nothing like that. It's more like about looking great in a quite casual way.
I think that's interesting, because I know some people sometimes observe and say, oh, you know, a lot of Swedes dress in kind of a similar way, or they're not really brave with experimenting with styles. But do you think that's changing? Are they a bit bolder now?
I think it's changing. I mean, the younger generation is probably traveling more, and also due to internet and all the fashion blogs all over the world. I mean, you get a lot of inspiration, but there still is a kind of a Swedish look. It's slightly more androgynous and dressed down, I would say, than if you would, you know, watch out the street in New York or in London or in Paris. So, we have a Swedish look, but it might be changing.
Now, you mentioned you'd been at a show earlier this morning. Are there any other actual brands that we should be looking out for, particular doing anything really exciting at the moment?
I think that there are a couple of new up-and-coming designers. There is a brand called Altavice Solme. They are absolutely great. They do women's and men's. They're just showing their third season, but it's really the talk of town, I would say. And even Crown Princess chose to wear a dress from them at last night's Polar Music Prize, which is a huge thing because they're different to what she normally wears. So that was a really cool thing. Otherwise, there is a brand called Dagmar, also an accessory designer called Maria Nilsdotter, who is really amazing, and she's starting to sell as well abroad now. So there are a few really good and very consistent brands that keep on showing better and better things all the time.
And do you get the sense that Swedes are really keen on their own brands? Is there a feeling of, you know, sort of national pride almost? Or are they equally open to, you know, the big international fashion houses?
I think the Swedes are quite proud of their style and look, and we, I think we want to be ambassadors when we travel. We want to wear Acne or Y-Red or Filippa K. It's like, you know, it's part of our kind of costume. So yeah, I definitely think that we want to show what we have here.
Now, Emilio, I couldn't sort of have this chat without asking you about fashion and music. And I mean, they all so complement each other around the world. Is that the same in Sweden? Are these two things really interconnected, fashion and music?
Absolutely. It's really nice to see how the designers here work with a lot of artists. I do a lot of projects with Alta Visome, the brand I was recently mentioning. And I mean, Acne work with Robin and Licky Lee. And it's very interesting to see how they go well hand in hand and they inspire each other. So it's important. There's a new brand called Icona Pop, a new Swedish girl duo who I really think you should look after. And they are the new fashion darlings in Sweden.
They sound like one to watch. And Emilia, just finally, when will we be hearing from you again? What's your sort of next plans with the music-wise?
Well, when I'm not reporting from Fashion Week and doing all my other hundreds of projects that I'm doing, I'm also in the studio writing new material. So definitely, you won't have to wait too long for a new album to come out. It's on its way.
And that was singer, writer and Monocle regular Emilia Depere talking to Tom Edwards earlier. And you're listening to Midori House. Now we should have some music from the person we just spoke to. This is Weightless by Emilia Depere.
Let me drift from you.
And that was Emilia Depere with Weightless. And I wish, in a way, that we'd had a video conference call with Emilia and Tom Edwards that you could have seen rather than listening to. Because on the subject of fashion, she knows a bit about it. She's a very sort of statuesque blonde Swede and wears the hugest stacked heels you could possibly imagine. She does wear the most oversized coats you could imagine. And I think that would have been quite a meeting of minds, seeing Tom Edwards, a man who favours navy, not unlike myself, and the statuesque Swedish sort of fashionista and bombshell that is Emilia Depere. And she was lucky enough to perform that song Weightless, I think, for a formerly winter series for us in said outfit. And coming up next, it's sort of time to sign off. So I'll leave you that. On Midori House, that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. In 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds will be back with the Monocle Daily. Tyler Brulé will be back with the Midori House at the same time tomorrow. And that's it for now. Thanks for tuning in.